You may be seated.
All right, you'll notice that Justice O'Neill has recused from this matter, and in his place is Judge William Klatt from the 10th District Court of Appeals. Welcome, Judge Klatt.
Thank you
for agreeing to sit. We will now proceed with case number 11-0778, State versus Noling. The appellant, Ms. Wood.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court.
Can you speak up, please?
Absolutely. My name is Carrie Wood, and I represent the appellant, Tyrone Noling. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. I'd like to begin today by discussing the two reasons that we're here before the court today. The first reason is that the Ohio General Assembly passed the Innocence Protection Act, which is referred to by its numerical designation within the briefs as Senate Bill 77.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
I apologize. Let me try that again. We begin here today for the first reason I began to discuss is that we're here because the Ohio General Assembly passed the Innocence Protection Act, which is referred to by its numerical designation in the briefs as Senate Bill 77. There are two purposes to this legislation. The first purpose was to assist in preventing wrongful convictions from occurring. The second purpose of the legislation was to ease the process to undo those wrongful convictions that have already occurred. And that is primarily accomplished in the legislation by giving greater access to DNA testing, which is the primary reason we're here today. The second reason is this court's decision in State versus Davis, which has called into question the constitutionality of 2953-73E1. And I'd like to begin today with the first question taken up by the court, the issue of statutory interpretation. The question really is that an eligible inmate under the DNA testing application, there's a set of acceptance criteria. And the question for the court is, when the Ohio General Assembly changes that acceptance criteria to allow for more DNA testing rather than less, is 2953-72A7 a bar? And the answer, quite simply, is no. And to understand how that answer comes about, it's important to step through the history of Mr. Noling's case. Mr. Noling's first application for DNA testing was in 2008. And that Mr. Noling, in his application for DNA testing, set out all of the factors of the acceptance criteria as to why his application should be accepted. The trial court denied his application based on one and only one of those acceptance criteria. 2953-74A, which talks about whether or not there was a definitive DNA test. And to reject Mr. Noling's application, he used the Ninth District's opinion in State versus Parade, which that case has subsequently been rejected, or that interpretation of definitive DNA tests has subsequently been rejected by this court. After Mr. Noling's application was denied, the Ohio General Assembly passed Senate Bill 77. And specifically what we're talking about here today, not just 2953-74A, but the definition of definitive DNA test. That was the change in the statute where the Ohio General Assembly said more DNA testing, not less. We want to find out what the truth is.
Well, counsel, let's jump down to what this all means. You'd like the DNA testing, retesting of the cigarette, is that right?
The short answer to that question is yes, but the question before the court is really one of, does 72A7, once there has been a change in the acceptance criteria, is that a bar? That is the question before the court today, and the answer is no. But to answer Your Honor's question, yes, we believe.
And there is, in the interim, the technology has improved to the point that when the cigarette was previously tested, they couldn't match it up with DNA from individuals. What's happened in the science?
The science at the time of Mr. Noling's trial, the science that was available was almost akin to blood typing. That was the kind of technology that was available at the time. What the technology today does is the DNA testing that's available today allows you to identify a single individual. The DNA technology that's available today is what has allowed the FBI to create CODIS, which has become...
And as far as you know, this cigarette that was once tested still is available, still
yes.
can harvest DNA, and you have DNA from the now deceased alternative, in your view, alternative suspect.
Mr. Wilson's DNA is in CODIS, yes, Your Honor.
Right. So that's the bottom line. If you get through the legal issues, it's still not proof that that individual was the perpetrator. It would be proof that a cigarette that he touched was in the victim's driveway.
I would disagree with Your Honor on that point. The cigarette butt is actually a very important piece of evidence.
Well, that's all it's proof of, isn't it? Is a cigarette butt that if it confirmed his connection to that cigarette, that he dropped that cigarette in the driveway.
The cigarette butt was collected by police officers who processed the crime scene.
Where was it located when they found it?
It was on the driveway, Your Honor.
Pardon me, please?
The driveway.
Outside
of the victim's home.
Home.
That's correct.
Near the sidewalk or near the home?
The driveway. Not in the curb, not on the street, in the driveway of the victim's home. The police believed, police collected it because they believed it was a relevant piece of evidence. Then that cigarette butt was sent to BCI.
Well, we know what happened, but
sure.
You haven't answered Justice Pfeiffer's question.
I apologize.
Assume for the moment that it does show that it belonged, or Mr. Wilson at one point had control of it and it had his DNA on it. That doesn't mean that Wilson perpetrated that offense or that your client didn't.
The consideration of DNA testing and whether or not something would be outcome determinative doesn't just look at the DNA test itself. It considers all available admissible evidence.
So at the most, you would get a request for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence? Or what is the link of assuming that the tests were ordered, that Wilson's DNA were on that cigarette?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean?
That means... Hopefully, Mr. Nolan is innocent of the crime and that he at the very least deserves a new trial. He does not deserve to be on death row for a crime that Dan Wilson confessed to, not under police interrogation, but confessed to his stepbrother.
Well, and didn't Nolan confess to it also to some fellow folks who were in lockup, and didn't three of his buddies implicate him and implicate themselves in the meantime in admission. So everybody's admitting to this. People, the list of characters who admit to this at one time, they're mutually exclusive. So there are a whole host of folks who want to take credit for this for some reason.
Mr. Nolan's three co-defendants, all very young boys at the time, have all since recanted those statements. And in fact, two of the co-defendants had tried to recant. One of them recanted prior to trial. One tried to recant.
Why would you admit to a double murder that implicates yourself in it? What's the motivation for doing that?
There are a whole host of reasons why false confessions occur, Your Honor. And there's been multiple cases that show DNA testing shows that false confessions have occurred. I think the
I understand.
Most. And when you have young men under the threat of a death penalty, under intense interrogation, those are all factors. And there was actually an expert for the initial new trial motion that said these are all factors in looking at it and deciding whether or not this is a false confession. You know what would tell us whether or not Mr. Wilson's confession was correct?
Let me jump you down to the second issue, because the time's going to run out here pretty fast, and that is you were asked to brief whether or not the statute itself unconstitutionally sends these cases directly to us.
That's correct.
And you argue that it is unconstitutional. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
How does that help your client?
I think that what it helps do is to give him the appellate process that he's constitutionally entitled to, that he did not receive.
Two bites at the apple instead of one.
I think jurisdiction is something that can't be waived, and I think that's why the court posed the question. Subject matter jurisdiction can't be waived. And I think that, with respect to...
But the General Assembly said for this procedure, and you're happy that they have refined this procedure, they said if you lose at the trial court, your appeal is directly to the Supreme Court.
That's correct, but if you have...
And if I read the Constitution in terms of the Court of Appeals powers, the General Assembly can do that, can't they?
It's important to read the Constitution with respect to what it can do with respect to jurisdiction with this court. 2B2C controls jurisdiction of this court, and what 2B2C says, an appeal of right or an appeal to this court is controlled solely by the Constitution. 3B2, which discusses the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals, says Court of Appeals gets jurisdiction through the Ohio Constitution plus a statute. So in order to determine whether or not this court has jurisdiction, it's all about Ohio's constitution. And what this court said in State versus Davis was that we only are...
But in Davis, we weren't dealing with a statute where the General Assembly said appeal should be directly to the Supreme Court. We were dealing with motions for new trial and those kinds of things, not a statutory right that's afforded the defendant. Here, the General Assembly afforded a specific right to defendants, and if the defendant is unsatisfied with the result in the trial court, the General Assembly said, you go directly to the Supreme Court. I don't see, in looking at the two constitutional provisions relating to the Supreme Court and to the Court of Appeals, how they cannot do that.
Ohio's Constitution says that the General Assembly can pass laws with respect to the appellate process for courts of appeals and giving an appeal of right to courts of appeals.
Right.
The Ohio Constitution says it's the Constitution that dictates the appeals of right or jurisdiction of this court. And so that very first sentence in 73E1 that has the General Assembly legislating when this court has jurisdiction is in direct contradiction to the language of Davis and to the language of Ohio's Constitution.
But the language of Davis focused on the Court of Appeals constitutional provision.
But
it's slightly different when you look at the Supreme Court's provision.
I think what Davis continued to do was to try to read into harmony 2B2C and 3B2. And what did that carving out of the direct appeal, was it only the direct appeal that came as an appeal of right directly to this court, or were there other post-conviction motions that also came to this court by the Ohio Constitution? And what the court said in Davis was no, it did not.
Yeah, well, let me read you 3B2 that we discussed in Davis. Except that courts of appeals shall not have jurisdiction to review on direct appeal a judgment that imposes a sentence of death. A judgment that imposes a sentence of death, and that's what Davis was about. When you look at 2B2C, direct appeals from the courts of common pleas or other courts of record inferior to the appeals and matters of right in cases in which the death penalty has been imposed. This is a case in which the death penalty has been imposed, is it not?
What this court says is that that small exception that's carved out in 3B2C was a narrow one, and it was only in reference to a direct appeal. The court said, we've always had these cases go up through the Court of Appeals. To say that every case that involves a death penalty case is now, that caseload is coming always and directly to this court, is not what that provision entailed.
Okay. Well, let me ask you one final question. Sure. You're here. Why wouldn't the best outcome for your client be for us to agree with you on the merit issue and say, you know, we have jurisdiction on this. The General Assembly gave it to us specifically, and we think the trial court was wrong, and send it back for the proper analysis under the current statute. That's what you want ultimately, isn't it?
That's correct, what we ultimately want, but
so why isn't that a good outcome for you?
That is the best outcome, but we do get there if the court sends it back to the 11th, lets them first give Mr. Noling the appellate process that he's constitutionally entitled to, and if the 11th is wrong and the court believes there's still an important issue to resolve, then the court can resolve it. If the court decides to resolve that issue here today and agrees that they have jurisdiction, the court should say more DNA testing and not less. I'm getting close to the end of my time. It's actually, I believe I'm over my time, so I will, unless there's any questions, I will conclude.
Thank you. Mr. Biglucci.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning. Let's start with the, I think, the appropriate first step, and it is whether this should even be in our court.
The Davis issue is... It's an interesting one. We also looked at it carefully and briefed it, and frankly, this court could, under its interpretations and the very narrow interpretation it gave the Constitution in Davis, find that this should go to the Court of Appeals. But I think there are other alternatives that the court should consider, and Justice Pfeiffer hit on the one that I was going to talk about first, and that is the language of the Constitution itself first, and looking at 3B2, and Justice Pfeiffer quoted the latter part of that paragraph. I'm going to quote the earlier part of the paragraph where it says that the courts of appeals shall have such jurisdiction as may be provided by law to review and affirm. And provided by law, in this case, is the restriction under 2953.73. Which divests the appellate court of jurisdiction. So I think the court could take that avenue and say that the appellate courts, while they are creatures of the Constitution itself uses language as may be provided by law.
And counsel, speaking of the Constitution, under 402B, 2 small I, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction in cases in which the death penalty has been affirmed. That's also a section that could apply in this particular case, could it not?
Yes, certainly. It could, and your reading of 4.2c, when they talk about cases in which the death penalty has been imposed, this is certainly a case such as that. We also, in our brief, talk about the fact that this court has already had this issue before it previously. This is their second attempt at DNA testing, of subsequent DNA testing for this cigarette butt. And the court previously denied jurisdiction on this exact same issue, the testing of the cigarette butt. So there is a law of the case argument to be made, too, that this case is done as far as the appellate process in this particular case.
Except for the statute that allows for new technology to be employed for retesting once new technology is developed and its application is warranted. And that's what the argument is here, that the sophisticated DNA testing, while the previous DNA testing, I believe, excluded Mr. Noling.
And his co-defendants.
The current DNA testing is asked to be matched up with the DNA of the deceased Mr. Wilson.
Only if it's outcome determinative. I mean, nothing's changed about that requirement. And the trial court said in its decision that Noling had failed to meet the acceptance criteria, which is the word in the journal entry, the acceptance criteria of 2953.
All right, let me ask you, say we get to the point and we'll have to weed through the, alleged conflict between the Constitution and the statute, but say we get to the point where there is the question of whether we order the testing, and you're saying it is not outcome determinative because they cannot use, if they do determine that Mr. Wilson's DNA matches that of the cigarette butt, that's merely one fact that would be introduced at a new trial, which is not, are you downplaying the significance of that?
Well, certainly. It's certainly not outcome determinative if somebody flicked a cigarette out of their car as they passed the Hartigs' house. Has nothing to do with the crime.
Well, scene. Don't they have coupled with his foster brother's statement that, and I didn't read verbatim what the foster brother said, but there is, I don't know whether it was, I wouldn't be surprised if Wilson had done this, or Wilson told me he had killed these this couple. I'm not exactly sure, but anyway, that's information to be interjected to a new trial if we get to that point.
Two things on that, Justice. First of all, the court's already heard the new trial motion based on that new evidence.
Not the DNA evidence, based on the foster brothers discussion.
Right, and rejected that as being incredible and unreliable. The federal district court has also reviewed that new evidence in habeas and rejected it. Secondly, I really object to the appellant here claiming that that this alternative suspect has confessed by some way. That isn't the case at all. He was somebody that the police ruled out very early in this investigation. And then some 20 years later, they produced this affidavit from a foster child who happened to live in the same foster home, not at the same time as Davis. And he says in his affidavit that he could have committed the crime, that something he would do. I mean, how that relates to a confession.
So there is no confession, no discussion between Mr. Wilson and this foster person.
And it would be inadmissible hearsay of this Nathan Chesley anyway.
Right.
I mean, in no way that's coming in at trial. This is a speculation of the nth degree, and it's building hearsay upon speculation upon hearsay. There's no way that this is outcome determinative. Even if this cigarette butt were smoked by Mr. Davis, which there's no indication that Davis was anywhere in the area,
Wilson,
had anything to do with
Wilson.
This, I'm sorry, Wilson, had anything to do with this crime. So
pretty sure Davis wasn't there.
Yeah, sorry. And the trial court saw that when it rejected both of these applications for subsequent DNA testing. What better evidence can there be for the defense than we tested it and excluded them? And the jury had this information.
Well, and that seems to be the interesting part of this. We're not now talking about DNA evidence to exclude. We're talking about DNA evidence to identify an individual. Is that what makes it a different type of animal here? I mean, we're talking about doing something different, not excluding many individuals, but absolutely identifying a specific person.
If this was DNA that was found on the victim, or it was semen, or amylase, or blood, or something that was tested initially and was inconclusively determined, we don't know who it is, then you're right. Then it would be important. But that isn't this animal.
And that's why the outcome determinative as well as definitive test work together.
Exactly. And that's why there's a two-pronged test in 295374 that even if they made the prior definitive DNA test hump, which I don't think they can, they'll never make the outcome determinative test on this particular piece of evidence.
So back to the trial court. You disagree also that the trial court didn't operate under the new statute, or should we send this back and tell the trial court to get to the two issues you're talking about?
I think the trial court, here's his order. If the court rejects an eligible offender's application for DNA testing because the offender does not satisfy the acceptance criteria described in A4 of this section, the court will not accept or consider subsequent applications. And I think acceptance criteria, if you look at 295374, there's really three, A, B, and C. You got to get through all three of those to get this tested. And that encompasses the prior definitive definition and the outcome determinative definition. I think the trial court got it right.
Well, counsel for the defendant is arguing that the trial court used an interpretation of the new statute that was wrong and never got to the questions that it was required under the statute to get to. Am I understanding correctly the dispute at that level, back at the trial court level?
Well, the trial court did say in its second opinion that the first one was a prior definitive test. The trial court did say that. In the first decision, there was no definition.
And you would agree that that's wrong?
Well, what's wrong?
That the first test was a definitive test.
I think it was definitive. How more definitive can you get than excluding the defendant? What did change is in the court's first decision, there was no definition in the statute of prior definitive. Between the first and the second, the legislature did make a definition of prior definitive. And that definition doesn't even contemplate this set of facts. It truly does not.
So we're not saying that you have to have someone identified for it to be a definitive test. That's not what the statute is saying, correct?
I agree with that.
All right.
Given the fact situation, which I talked with you about previously, mm-hmm. where that would be relevant to identify an unknown DNA substance of some relevance, like the Parade case. But that isn't what we have here. And I think the trial court recognized that. Now, it may have been inartfully said that this one is also definitive, but he also goes on to say that this defendant doesn't meet the application criteria and cites 74. And A, B, and C are the acceptance criteria. And if you go through A, B, and C in that, even if you make A, which is the prior definitive test, you don't make B, which is outcome determinative, nor do you make C, which is also outcome determinative. It just doesn't get there. The state submits that this is done for purposes of delay only, and that while we want to get to the truth as much as anybody else, this isn't one of those cases where DNA has some relevance.
Well, this is a circumstantial evidence case, isn't it?
No. As the court pointed out earlier, the defendant made admissions to female friends of his, to a law enforcement officer, to a corrections officer. He took the sheriff on a trip to recover the murder weapon.
And did they recover it?
No, they recovered another weapon that he used in a prior burglary. Same caliber, but another 25 caliber handgun that he used in a previous robbery of elderly people. Same
MO.
He
never did recover the murder weapon.
And not in this case. Right. He took them to a weapon that was used, and that was their MO, him and his gang here, is to rob old people after they got their Social Security checks by using the ruse of my car has broken down to get into their homes, exactly what they did here. And he did take the sheriff. And although in the course of that trip, he admitted his involvement, although he said St. Clair, the co-defendant, pulled the trigger. He admitted his involvement in the crime itself.
Did the police investigator, was Wilson a suspect at that time?
I didn't hear you.
Did the police investigate, or was Wilson a suspect at that time?
Yes, the police did investigate Wilson. There was a lot of even newspaper coverage about Wilson because he was a criminal of some notoriety in the area. In fact, has been executed for his crime since. And yes, it was a big deal in the newspapers about Wilson that he could have done this because he's a notorious criminal. He was in Lorain County, where he burned his girlfriend alive in the trunk of her car.
But he was excluded, did you say earlier? You said he was excluded early on in the investigation. I thought I heard you say that.
Yeah, he was looked at, and he was not obviously charged. So yes, I would say he was excluded along with some other possibilities. Before this case was cracked, when Noling and St. Clair got into a fight in another jail about who pulled the trigger here and who was a snitch.
And there's never been a DNA match to determine if it is in fact Wilson's DNA on that cigarette butt that was recovered?
No.
Okay.
You said this is all about delay. I assume you're talking about delaying the setting of a date for execution.
Yes. Nothing further, Your Honors. Thank you. I'd ask to affirm the decision of the trial court.
Thank you. Ms. Woods, you've used all your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. I know the state has discussed a number of issues which I cannot possibly address in 30 seconds, so I'm just going to leave the court with this. The question before the court is whether the Court of Common Pleas should consider whether there's a definitive DNA test under the new statute that the legislature...
Counsel, the legislation is geared towards the defendant, including or excluding the defendant. And here, even though it's more sophisticated, it's not going to, your client has been excluded as the donor of the DNA on that cigarette butt.
If the court looks at the new definition of definitive DNA test, which corrected only looking at an exclusion result, which was what the Ninth District said in Praed. Ninth District said in Praed, you only look at exclusion result. The Ohio General Assembly changed the definition to say that is not the only thing that you look at. You look at an exclusion result and whether DNA testing can determine if the perpetrator's DNA was recovered from the scene of the crime. And the subsequent question, which is additionally in the definition of definitive DNA test. Can DNA technology give you more information about the perpetrator of the crime?
But 295374 says those tests must be outcome determinative. And if I understood Mr. Baglucci's argument, it is, even if you know that this was in fact Daniel Wilson's DNA on the cigarette butt recovered from the driveway, it's not outcome determinative as to this case.
It is outcome determinative. Outcome determinative doesn't require exoneration.
Pardon me, please.
Outcome determinative requires the consideration of the DNA evidence in addition to all available admissible evidence. The recantations of all three co-defendants, the confession by Dan Wilson, the DNA that places Dan Wilson at the scene of the crime where he had absolutely no reason to be there.
What's
That's
your
the
definition of his confession?
The initial police report says that Dan Wilson says that, or Dan Wilson told his foster brother, Nathan Chesley, that he had committed this crime. Subsequent conversations with Mr. Chesley, which have never been heard by the Court of Common Pleas, Mr. Chesley has never testified. It's not true that the Court of Common Pleas has rejected his testimony as incredible or inadmissible. It's never been heard.
And it seems as though a generous review of the state's evidence is equal culpability of your client, Mr. Noling, who has taken the police, told them what facts there are, and in fact confessed to the police about this incident and the murder of these two individuals.
The confessions of the co-defendants are fairly inconsistent with the facts of the crime. But we're talking about physical evidence, and we're talking about the cigarette butt, and I think we can all rest assured that if that DNA on the cigarette butt was actually came back and said it was Mr. Noling's, that surely would have been the centerpiece of the state's case of Mr. Noling at the time. So it's incomprehensible to say that if that cigarette butt placed Dan Wilson with, as Mr. Vellucci said, notoriety as someone who did this type of crime, who was in the area, unlike Mr. Noling, who had killed an elderly gentleman before, who had subsequently burned a woman alive in a car, that's not evidence that a jury should consider in a new trial. I very much disagree with that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision.